The sky was then covered by dense blue clouds, accompanied by lightning and thunder. Thus the sky and its natural illumination were covered in the same way that the spirit soul is covered by the three modes of material nature. With its rays, the sun had for 8 months drunk up the earth's wealth in the form of water. Now that the proper time had arrived, the sun began releasing this accumulated wealth. Flashing with lightning, great clouds were shaken and swept about by fierce winds. Just like merciful persons, the clouds gave their lives for the pleasure of this world. The earth had been emaciated by the summer heat, but she became fully nourished again when moistened by the god of rain. Thus, the earth was like a person whose body has been emaciated by austerities undergone for a material purpose, but who again becomes fully nourished when he achieves the fruit of those austerities. In the evening twilight during the rainy season, the darkness allowed the glowworms, but not the stars, to shine forth. Just as in the age of Kali, the predominance of sinful activities allows atheistic doctrines to overshadow the true knowledge of the Vedas. The frogs, who had all along been lying silent, suddenly began croaking when they heard the rumbling of the rain clouds, in the same way that Brahmin students, who perform their morning duties in silence, begin reciting their lessons when called by their teacher. With the advent of the rainy season, the insignificant streams, which had become dry, began to swell and then strayed from their proper courses, like the body, property, and money of a man controlled by the urges of his senses. The newly grown grass made the earth emerald green, the Indragopa insects added a reddish hue, and white mushrooms added further color and circles of shade. Thus the earth appeared like a person who has suddenly become rich. With their wealth of grains, the fields gave joy to the farmers, but created remorse in the hearts of those who were too proud to engage in farming and who failed to understand how everything is under the control of the Supreme. As all creatures of the land and water took advantage of the newly fallen rainwater, their forms became attractive and pleasing, just as a devotee becomes beautiful by engaging in the service of the Supreme Lord. Where the rivers joined the ocean, it became agitated, its waves blown about by the wind. Just as the mind of an immature yogi becomes agitated because he is still tainted by lust and attached to the objects of sense gratification. Just as devotees whose minds are absorbed in the personality of Godhead remain peaceful even when attacked by all sorts of dangers, the mountains in the rainy season were not at all disturbed by the repeated striking of the rain-bearing clouds. During the rainy season, the roads, not being cleansed, became covered with grass and debris and were thus difficult to make out. These roads were like religious scriptures that Brahmins no longer study and that thus become corrupted and covered over with the passage of time. Though the clouds are the well-wishing friends of all living beings, the lightning, fickle in its affinities, moved from one group of clouds to another, like lusty women unfaithful even to virtuous men. When the curved bow of Indra, the rainbow, appeared in the sky, which had the quality of thundering sound, it was unlike ordinary bows because it did not rest upon a string. Similarly, when the Supreme Lord appears in this world, which is the interaction of the material qualities, he is unlike ordinary persons because he remains free from all material qualities and independent of all material conditions. During the rainy season, the moon was prevented from appearing directly by the covering of the clouds, which were themselves illumined by the moon's rays. Similarly, the living being in material existence is prevented from appearing directly by the covering of the false ego, which is itself illumined by the consciousness of the pure soul. Peacocks became festive and cried out a joyful greeting when they saw the clouds arrive, just as people distressed in household life feel pleasure when the pure devotees of the infallible Supreme Lord visit them. The trees had grown thin and dry, but after they drank the newly fallen rainwater through their feet, their various bodily features blossomed. Similarly, one whose body has grown thin and weak from austerity again exhibits his healthy bodily features upon enjoying the material objects gained through that austerity. The cranes continued dwelling on the shores of the lakes, although the shores were agitated during the rainy season. Just as materialistic persons with contaminated minds always remain at home, despite the many disturbances there. When Indra sent forth his rains, the flood waters broke through the irrigation dikes in the agricultural fields. Just as in the Kali Yuga, the atheists' false theories break down the boundaries of Vedic injunctions. The clouds, impelled by the winds, released their nectarian water for the benefit of all living beings, just as kings, instructed by their Brahmin priests, dispensed charity to the citizens. When the Vrindavan forest had thus become resplendent, filled with ripe dates and jumbo fruits, Lord Krishna, surrounded by his cows and cowherd boyfriends, and accompanied by Sri Balaram, entered that forest to enjoy. The cows had to move slowly because of their weighty milk bags, but they quickly ran to the Supreme Personality of Godhead as soon as he called them, their affection for him causing their udders to become wet. The Lord saw the joyful aborigine girls of the forest, the trees dripping sweet sap, and the mountain waterfalls, whose resounding indicated that there were caves nearby. When it rained, the Lord would sometimes enter a cave or the hollow of a tree to play and to eat roots and fruits. Lord Krishna would take his meal of boiled rice and yogurt, sent from home, in the company of Lord Balaram and the cowherd boys who regularly ate with him. They would all sit down to eat on a large stone near the water. Lord Krishna watched the contented bulls, calves, and cows sitting on the green grass and grazing with closed eyes, and he saw that the cows were tired from the burden of their heavy milk bags. Thus observing the beauty and opulence of Vrindavan's rainy season, a perennial source of great happiness, the Lord offered all respect to that season, which was expanded from his own internal potency. While Lord Rama and Lord Keshava were thus dwelling in Vrindavan, the autumn season arrived, when the sky is cloudless, the water clear, and the wind gentle. The autumn season, which regenerated the lotus flowers, also restored the various bodies of water to their original purity, just as the process of devotional service purifies the minds of the fallen yogis when they return to it. Autumn cleared the sky of clouds, let the animals get out of their crowded living conditions, cleaned the earth of its covering of mud, and purified the water of contamination, in the same way that loving service rendered to Lord Krishna frees the members of the four spiritual orders from their respective troubles. The clouds, having given up all they possessed, shone forth with purified effulgence, just like peaceful sages who have given up all material desires and are thus free of all sinful propensities. During this season, the mountains sometimes released their pure water and sometimes did not, just as experts in transcendental science sometimes give the nectar of transcendental knowledge and sometimes do not. The fish swimming in the increasingly shallow water did not at all understand that the water was diminishing, just as foolish family men cannot see how the time they have left to live is diminishing with every passing day. Just as a miserly, poverty-stricken person overly absorbed in family affairs suffers because he cannot control his senses, the fish swimming in the shallow water had to suffer the heat of the autumn sun. Gradually, the different areas of land gave up their muddy condition, and the plants grew past their unripe stage, in the same way that sober sages give up egotism and possessiveness. These are based on things different from the real self, namely the material body and its byproducts. With the arrival of autumn, the ocean and the lakes became silent, their water still, just like a sage who has desisted from all material activities and given up his recitation of Vedic mantras. In the same way that the practitioners of yoga bring their senses under strict control to check their consciousness from flowing out through the agitated senses, the farmers erected strong mud banks to keep the water within their rice fields from draining out. The autumn moon relieved all creatures of the suffering caused by the sun's rays, just as wisdom relieves a person of the misery caused by his identifying with his material body, and as Lord Mukunda relieves Vrindavan's ladies of the distress caused by their separation from him. Free of clouds and filled with clearly visible stars, the autumn sky shone brilliantly, just like the spiritual consciousness of one who has directly experienced the purport of the Vedic scriptures. The full moon shone in the sky, surrounded by stars, just as Sri Krishna, the lord of the Yadu dynasty, shone brilliantly on the earth, surrounded by all the Vrishnis. Except for the gopis, whose hearts had been stolen by Krishna, the people could forget their suffering by embracing the wind coming from the flower-filled forest. This wind was neither hot nor cold. By the influence of the autumn season, all the cows, doe, women, and female birds became fertile and were followed by their respective mates in search of sexual enjoyment. Just as activities performed for the service of the Supreme Lord are automatically followed by all beneficial results. O King Pariksit, when the autumn sun rose, all the lotus flowers blossomed happily, except the night-blooming Kumut. Just as in the presence of a strong ruler, everyone becomes fearless, except the thieves. In all the towns and villages, people held great festivals, performing the Vedic fire sacrifice for honoring and tasting the first grains of the new harvest, along with similar celebrations that followed local custom and tradition. Thus the earth, rich with newly grown grain, and especially beautified by the presence of Krishna and Balaram, shone beautifully as an expansion of the Supreme Lord. The merchants, sages, kings, and brahmachari students, kept in by the rain, were at last free to go out and attain their desired objects, just as those who achieve perfection in this life can, when the proper time comes, leave the material body and attain their respective forms. Chapter 21, the Gopis glorify the song of Krishna's flute. Shukadeva Goswami said, "Thus the Vrindavan forest was filled with transparent autumnal waters and cooled by breezes perfumed with the fragrance of lotus flowers growing in the clear lakes. The infallible Lord, accompanied by his cows and cowherd boyfriends, entered that Vrindavan forest. The lakes, rivers, and hills of Vrindavan resounded with the sounds of maddened bees and flocks of birds moving about the flowering trees. In the company of the cowherd boys and Balaram, Lord Krishna entered that forest, and while herding the cows, he began to vibrate his flute. When the young ladies in the cowherd village of Braja heard the song of Krishna's flute, which arouses the influence of Cupid, some of them privately began describing Krishna's qualities to their intimate friends. The cowherd girls began to speak about Krishna, but when they remembered his activities, the power of Cupid disturbed their minds, and thus they could not speak. Wearing a peacock feather ornament upon his head, blue karnikara flowers on his ears, a yellow garment as brilliant as gold, and the Vaijayanti garland, Lord Krishna exhibited his transcendental form as the greatest of dancers as he entered the forest of Vrindavan, beautifying it with the marks of his footprints. He filled the holes of his flute with the nectar of his lips, and the cowherd boys sang his glories. O King, when the young ladies in Braja heard the sound of Krishna's flute, which steals away the minds of all living beings, they all embraced one another and began describing it.
Shri Gopya Uchu Akshandatam Palamidam Parangvadamak Sakya Pasunan Vivesha Yatova Yasyai Vaktram Vajesu Sutayohan Venu Jishtam Yavana Pita Manurak Takataksha Moksham Chuta Pavala Bahasta Bhagot Palabja Malana Pitta Paridana Vachitta Vesho Manhe Varejita Dadamba Shupala Goshtyam Vange Yatana Tavaro Kachagaya Mano Gopyakyamatradayam kushalam smavenum Dhamodaradabasudamapi gopikanam Bhukte swayam yadavashishtadasangradinyo Rishyapachoshumamachu swadavoyataya Vrindavanam sakibhavadanoti kirtim Yandevati sutapadam vajalamda lakshmi Govinda venamunamattamayuram vityam Bhikshadvisam ratadatam yasamastha sadvam.
The cowherd girl said, "O friends, those eyes that see the beautiful faces of the sons of Maharaj Nanda are certainly fortunate. As these two sons enter the forest, surrounded by their friends, driving the cows before them, they hold their flutes to their mouths and glance lovingly upon the residents of Vrindavan. For those who have eyes, we think there is no greater object of vision. Dressed in a charming variety of garments, upon which their garlands rest, and decorating themselves with peacock feathers, lotuses, lilies, newly grown mango sprouts, and clusters of flower buds, Krishna and Balaram shine forth magnificently among the assembly of cowherd boys. They look just like the best of dancers appearing on a dramatic stage, and sometimes they sing. My dear gopis, what auspicious activities must the flute have performed to enjoy the nectar of Krishna's lips independently, and leave only a taste for us gopis, for whom that nectar is actually meant? The forefathers of the flute, the bamboo trees, shed tears of pleasure. His mother, the river on whose bank the bamboo was born, feels jubilant, and therefore her blooming lotus flowers are standing like hair on her body. O friend, Vrindavan is spreading the glory of the earth, having obtained the treasure of the lotus feet of Krishna, the son of Devaki. The peacocks dance madly when they hear Govinda's flute, and when other creatures see them from the hilltops, they all become stunned. Blessed are all these foolish deer, because they have approached Maharaj Nanda's son, who is gorgeously dressed and is playing on his flute. Indeed, both the doe and the bucks worship the Lord with looks of love and affection. Krishna's beauty and character create a festival for all women. Indeed, when the demigods' wives flying in airplanes with their husbands catch sight of him and hear his resonant flute song, their hearts are shaken by Cupid, and they become so bewildered that the flowers fall out of their hair and their belts loosen. Using their upraised ears as vessels, the cows are drinking the nectar of the flute song flowing out of Krishna's mouth. The calves, their mouths full of milk from their mother's moist nipples, stand still as they take Govinda within themselves through their tear-filled eyes and embrace him within their hearts. O Mother, in this forest all the birds have risen onto the beautiful branches of the trees to see Krishna. With closed eyes they are simply listening in silence to the sweet vibrations of his flute, and they are not attracted by any other sound. Surely these birds are on the same level as great sages. When the rivers hear the flute song of Krishna, their minds begin to desire him, and thus the flow of their currents is broken, and their waters are agitated, moving around in whirlpools. Then, with the arms of their waves, the rivers embrace Murari's lotus feet, and, holding on to them, present offerings of lotus flowers. In the company of Balaram and the cowherd boys, Lord Krishna is continually vibrating his flute as he herds all the animals of Braja, even under the full heat of the summer sun. Seeing this, the cloud in the sky has expanded himself out of love. He is rising high and constructing out of his own body, with its multitude of flower-like droplets of water, an umbrella for the sake of his friend. The aborigine women of the Vrindavan area become disturbed by lust when they see the grass marked with reddish kumkum powder. Endowed with the color of Krishna's lotus feet, this powder originally decorated the breasts of his beloveds. And when the aborigine women smear it on their faces and breasts, they give up all their anxiety. Of all the devotees, this Govardhan Hill is the best. Oh, my friends, this hill supplies Krishna and Balaram, along with their calves, cows, and cowherd friends, with all kinds of necessities. Water for drinking, very soft grass, caves, fruits, flowers, and vegetables. In this way, the hill offers respects to the Lord. Being touched by the lotus feet of Krishna and Balaram, Govardhan Hill appears very jubilant. My dear friends, as Krishna and Balaram pass through the forest with their cowherd friends, leading their cows, they carry ropes to bind the cow's rear legs at the time of milking. When Lord Krishna plays on his flute, the sweet music causes the moving living entities to become stunned and the non-moving trees to tremble with ecstasy. These things are certainly very wonderful. Thus narrating to one another the playful pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as he wandered about in the Vrindavan forest, the gopis became fully absorbed in thoughts of him. Chapter 22. Krishna Steals the Garments of the Unmarried Gopis. Shukadeva Goswami said, "During the first month of the winter season, the young unmarried girls of Gokula observed the vow of worshipping goddess Katyayini. For the entire month, they ate only unspiced khichdi. My dear king, after they had bathed in the water of the Yamuna just as the sun was rising, the gopis made an earthen deity of goddess Durga on the riverbank. Then they worshipped her with such aromatic substances as sandalwood pulp, along with other items both opulent and simple, including lamps, fruits, betel nuts, newly grown leaves, and fragrant garlands and incense. Each of the young unmarried girls performed her worship while chanting the following mantra: O goddess Katyayini, O great potency of the Lord, O possessor of great mystic power and mighty controller of all, please make the son of Nanda Maharaj my husband. I offer my obeisances unto you. Thus, for an entire month, the girls carried out their vow and properly worshipped the goddess Bhadrakali, fully absorbing their minds in Krishna and meditating upon the following thought: may the son of King Nanda become my husband. Each day they rose at dawn, calling out to one another by name. They all held hands and loudly sang the glories of Krishna while going to the Kalindi to take their bath. One day they came to the riverbank and, putting aside their clothing as they had done before, happily played in the water while singing the glories of Krishna. Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the master of all masters of mystic yoga, was aware of what the gopis were doing, and thus he went there surrounded by his young companions to award the gopis the perfection of their endeavor. Taking the girls' garments, he quickly climbed to the top of a kadamba tree. Then, as he laughed loudly and his companions also laughed, he addressed the girls jokingly. "My dear girls, you may each come here as you wish and take back your garments. I'm telling you the truth and I'm not joking with you, since I see your fatigue from executing austere vows. I have never before spoken a lie, and these boys know it. Therefore, O slender-waisted girls, please come forward, either one by one or all together, and pick out your clothes." Seeing how Krishna was joking with them, the gopis became fully immersed in love for him, and as they glanced at each other, they began to laugh and joke among themselves, even in their embarrassment. But still, they did not come out of the water. As Sri Govinda spoke to the gopis in this way, his joking words completely captivated their minds. Submerged up to their necks in the cold water, they began to shiver. Thus they addressed him as follows: "Dear Krishna, don't be unfair. We know that you are the respectable son of Nanda and that you are honored by everyone in Braja. You are also very dear to us. Please give us back our clothes. We are shivering in the cold water." "Oh, Shyama Sundar, we are your maidservants and must do whatever you say. But give us back our clothing. You know what the religious principles are, and if you don't give us our clothes, we will have to tell the king. Please." The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "If you girls are actually my maidservants, and if you will really do what I say, then come here with your innocent smiles and let each girl pick out her clothes. If you don't do what I say, I won't give them back to you. And even if the king becomes angry, what can he do?" Then, shivering from the painful cold, all the young girls rose up out of the water, covering their pubic area with their hands. When the Supreme Lord saw how the gopis were struck with embarrassment, he was satisfied by their pure loving affection. Putting their clothes on his shoulder, the Lord smiled and spoke to them with affection. "You girls bathed naked while executing your vow, and that is certainly an offense against the demigods. To counteract your sin, you should offer obeisances while placing your folded hands above your heads. Then you should take back your lower garments." Thus the young girls of Vrindavan, considering what Lord Achyuta had told them, accepted that they had suffered a fall down from their vow by bathing naked in the river. But they still desired to successfully complete their vow, and since Lord Krishna is himself the ultimate result of all pious activities, they offered their obeisances to him to cleanse away all their sins. Seeing them bow down like that, the Supreme Lord, the son of Devaki, gave them back their garments, feeling compassionate toward them and satisfied by their acts. Although the gopis had been thoroughly cheated, deprived of their modesty, ridiculed, and made to act just like toy dolls, and although their clothing had been stolen, they did not feel at all inimical toward Sri Krishna. Rather, they were simply joyful to have this opportunity to associate with their beloved. The gopis were addicted to associating with their beloved Krishna, and thus they became captivated by him. Thus, even after putting their clothes on, they did not move. They simply remained where they were, shyly glancing at him. The Supreme Lord understood the determination of the gopis in executing their strict vow. The Lord also knew that the girls desired to touch his lotus feet, and thus Lord Damodar, Krishna, spoke to them as follows: "O saintly girls, I understand that your real motive in this austerity has been to worship me. That intent of yours is approved of by me, and indeed it must come to pass. The desire of those who fix their minds on me does not lead to material desire for sense gratification. Just as barleycorns burned by the sun and then cooked can no longer grow into new sprouts. Go now, girls, and return to Braja. Your desire is fulfilled, for in my company you will enjoy the coming nights. After all, this was the purpose of your vow to worship Goddess Katyayani, O pure-hearted ones." Shukadev Goswami said, "Thus instructed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the young girls, their desire now fulfilled, could bring themselves only with great difficulty to return to the village of Braja, meditating all the while upon his lotus feet. Sometime later, Lord Krishna, the son of Devaki, surrounded by his cowherd friends and accompanied by his elder brother Balaram, went a good distance away from Vrindavan, herding the cows. When the sun's heat became intense, Lord Krishna saw that the trees were acting as umbrellas by shading him, and thus he spoke as follows to his boyfriends. O Stoka Krishna and Anshu, O Sridhama, Subal and Arjuna, O Vrishabha, Ojasvi, Devaprastha and Bharutapa, just see these greatly fortunate trees whose lives are completely dedicated to the benefit of others. Even while tolerating the wind, rain, heat and snow, they protect us from these elements. Just see how these trees are maintaining every living entity. Their birth is successful. Their behavior is just like that of great personalities, for anyone who asks anything from a tree never goes away disappointed. These trees fulfill one's desires with their leaves, flowers, and fruits, their shade, roots, bark, and wood, and also with their fragrance, sap, ashes, pulp, and shoots. It is the duty of every living being to perform welfare activities for the benefit of others with his life, wealth, intelligence, and words. Thus moving among the trees, whose branches were bent low by their abundance of twigs, fruits, flowers, and leaves, Lord Krishna came to the Yamuna River. The cowherd boys let the cows drink the clear, cool, and wholesome water of the Yamuna. O King Parikshit, the cowherd boys themselves also drank that sweet water to their full satisfaction. Then the cowherd boys began herding the animals in a leisurely way within the small forest along the Yamuna. But soon they became afflicted by hunger, and thus they approached Krishna and Balaram. Chapter 23, The Brahmin's Wives Blessed. The cowherd boys said, O Rama, Rama, mighty armed one, O Krishna, chastiser of the wicked, we are being harassed by hunger, and you should do something about it. Shukadeva Goswami said, thus entreated by the cowherd boys, the Supreme Lord, the son of Devaki, replied as follows, desiring to please certain of his devotees who were Brahmins' wives. Please go to the sacrificial arena where a group of Brahmins, learned in the Vedic injunctions, are now performing the Angi Rasa sacrifice to gain promotion to heaven. When you go there, my dear cowherd boys, simply request some food. Declare to them the name of my elder brother, the Supreme Lord Balaram, and also my name, and explain that you have been sent by us. Thus instructed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cowherd boys went to the sacrificial arena and submitted their request. They stood before the Brahmins with hands folded in supplication, and then fell flat on the ground to offer respect. O earthly gods, please hear us! We cowherd boys are executing the orders of Krishna, and we have been sent here by Balaram. We wish all good for you. Please acknowledge our arrival. Lord Rama and Lord Achyuta are tending their cows not far from here. They are hungry and want you to give them some of your food. Therefore, O Brahmins, O best of the knowers of religion, if you have faith, please give some food to them. Except during the interval between the initiation of the performer of a sacrifice and the actual sacrifice of the animal, O most pure Brahmins, it is not contaminating for even the initiated to partake of food, at least in sacrifices other than the Sautramani. The Brahmins heard this supplication from the Supreme Lord, yet they refused to pay heed. Indeed, they were full of petty desires and entangled in elaborate rituals. Though presuming themselves advanced in Vedic learning, they were actually inexperienced fools. Although the ingredients of sacrificial performance, the place, time, particular paraphernalia, mantras, rituals, priests, fires, demigods, performer, offering, and the as yet unseen beneficial results, all are simply aspects of his opulences, the Brahmins saw Lord Krishna as an ordinary human because of their perverted intelligence. They failed to recognize that he is the Supreme Absolute Truth, the directly manifest personality of Godhead, whom the material senses cannot ordinarily perceive. Thus bewildered by their false identification with the mortal body, they did not show him proper respect. When the Brahmins failed to reply even with a simple yes or no, the cowherd boys returned disappointed to Krishna and Rama and reported this to them. Hearing what had happened, Lord Krishna simply laughed. Then he again addressed the cowherd boys, showing them the way men act in this world. Tell the wives of the Brahmins that I have come here with Lord Balaram. They will certainly give you all the food you want. for they are most affectionate toward me, and, indeed, with their intelligence, reside in me alone. The coward boys then went to the house where the Brahmin's wives were staying. There the boys saw those chaste ladies sitting, nicely decorated with fine ornaments. Bowing down to the Brahmin ladies, the boys addressed them in all humility. Obeisances unto you, O wives of the learned Brahmins. Kindly hear our words. We have been sent here by Lord Krishna, who is passing by not far from here. He has come a long way with the coward boys and Lord Balaram, tending the cows. Now he is hungry, so some food should be given for him and his companions. The wives of the Brahmins were always eager to see Krishna, for their minds had been enchanted by descriptions of him. Thus, as soon as they heard that he had come, they became very excited. Taking along in large vessels the four kinds of foods, full of fine tastes and aromas, all the ladies went forth to meet their beloved, just as rivers flow toward the sea. Although their husbands, brothers, sons, and other relatives tried to forbid them from going, their hope of seeing Krishna, cultivated by extensive hearing of his transcendental qualities, won out. Along the river Yamuna, within a garden decorated with buds of Ashoka trees, they caught sight of him strolling along in the company of the coward boys and his elder brother Balaram. His complexion was dark blue and his garment golden. Wearing a peacock feather, colored minerals, sprigs of flower buds, and a garland of forest flowers and leaves, he was dressed just like a dramatic dancer. He rested one hand upon the shoulder of a friend and with the other twirled a lotus. Lilies graced his ears, his hair hung down over his cheeks, and his lotus-like face was smiling. For a long time, those Brahmin ladies had heard about Krishna, their beloved, and his glories had become the constant ornaments of their ears. Indeed, their minds were always absorbed in him. Through the apertures of their eyes, they now forced him to enter within their hearts, and then they embraced him within for a long time. In this way, they finally gave up the pain of separation from him, just as sages give up the anxiety of false ego by embracing their innermost consciousness. Lord Krishna, who witnesses the thoughts of all creatures, understood how those ladies had abandoned all worldly hopes and come there simply to see him. Thus he addressed them as follows with a smile upon his face. Welcome, O most fortunate ladies. Please sit down and make yourselves comfortable. What can I do for you? That you have come here to see me is most appropriate. Certainly, expert personalities, who can see their own true interest, render unmotivated and uninterrupted devotional service directly unto me, for I am most dear to the soul. It is only by contact with the self that one's vital breath, intelligence, mind, friends, body, wife, children, wealth, and so on are dear. Therefore, what object can possibly be more dear than one's own self? You should thus return to the sacrificial arena, because your husbands, the learned Brahmins, are householders and need your assistance to finish their respective sacrifices. The wives of the Brahmins replied, O Almighty One, please do not speak such cruel words. Rather, you should fulfill your promise that you always reciprocate with your devotees in kind. Now that we have attained your lotus feet, we simply wish to remain here in the forest so we may carry upon our heads the garlands of tulsi leaves you may neglectfully kick away with your lotus feet. We are ready to give up all material relationships. Our husbands, fathers, sons, brothers, other relatives and friends will no longer take us back, and how could anyone else be willing to give us shelter? Therefore, since we have thrown ourselves at your lotus feet and have no other destination, please, O chastiser of enemies, grant our desire. The Supreme Personality of Godhead replied, Rest assured that your husbands will not be inimical toward you, nor will your fathers, brothers, sons, other relatives, or the general populace. I will personally advise them of the situation. Indeed, even the demigods will express their approval. For you to remain in my bodily association would certainly not please people in this world, nor would it be the best way for you to increase your love for me. Rather, you should fix your minds on me, and very soon you will achieve me. It is by hearing about me, seeing my deity form, meditating upon me, and chanting my names and glories that love for me develops, not by physical proximity. Therefore, please go back to your homes. Srila Shukadeva Goswami said, Thus instructed, the wives of the Brahmins returned to the place of sacrifice. The Brahmins did not find any fault with their wives, and together with them they finished the sacrifice. One of the ladies had been forcibly kept back by her husband. When she heard the others describe the Supreme Lord, Krishna, She embraced him within her heart and gave up her material body, the basis of bondage to material activity. Lord Krishna fed the cowherd boys with that food of four varieties. Then the all-powerful Lord himself partook of the preparations. Thus the Supreme Lord, appearing like a human being to perform his pastimes, imitated the ways of human society. He enjoyed pleasing his cows, cowherd boyfriends, and cowherd girlfriends with his beauty, words, and actions. The Brahmins then came to their senses and began to feel great remorse. They thought, "We have sinned, for we have denied the request of the two lords of the universe, who deceptively appeared as ordinary human beings." Taking note of their wives' pure transcendental devotion for Lord Krishna, and seeing their own lack of devotion, the Brahmins felt most sorrowful and began to condemn themselves. "These women have never undergone the purificatory rites of the twice-born classes, nor have they lived as brahmacharis in the ashram of a spiritual master, nor have they executed austerities, speculated on the nature of the self, followed the formalities of cleanliness, or engaged in pious rituals. Nevertheless, they have firm devotion for Lord Krishna, whose glories are chanted by the exalted hymns of the Vedas, and who is the supreme master of all masters of mystic power. We, on the other hand, have no such devotion for the Lord, although we have executed all these processes. Indeed, infatuated as we are with our household affairs, we have deviated completely from the real aim of our life. But now just see how the Lord, through the words of these simple cowherd boys, has reminded us of the ultimate destination of all true transcendentalists. Otherwise, why would the Supreme Controller, whose every desire is already fulfilled, and who is the master of liberation and all other transcendental benedictions, enact this pretense with us, who are always to be controlled by him?" Hoping for the touch of his lotus feet, the goddess of fortune perpetually worships him alone, leaving aside all others and renouncing her pride and fickleness. That he begs is certainly astonishing to everyone. "To hell with our threefold birth, our vow of celibacy, and our extensive learning. To hell with our aristocratic background and our expertise in the rituals of sacrifice. These are all condemned because we were inimical to the transcendental personality of Godhead." The illusory potency of the Supreme Lord certainly bewilders even the great mystics. What to speak of us? As Brahmins, we are supposed to be the spiritual masters of all classes of men, yet we have been bewildered about our own real interest. Just see the unlimited love these women have developed for Lord Krishna, the spiritual master of the entire universe. This love has broken for them the very bonds of death, their attachment to family life. All the aspects of sacrifice, the auspicious place and time, the various items of paraphernalia, the Vedic hymns, the prescribed rituals, the priests and sacrificial fires, the demigods, the patron of the sacrifice, the sacrificial offering, and the pious results obtained, all are simply manifestations of his opulences. Yet even though we had heard that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, the Lord of all mystic controllers, had taken birth in the Yadu dynasty, we were so foolish that we could not recognize Sri Krishna to be none other than him. Let us offer our obeisances unto Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His intelligence is never bewildered, whereas we, confused by his power of illusion, are simply wandering about on the paths of fruitive work. We were bewildered by Lord Krishna's illusory potency, and thus could not understand his influence as the original personality of Godhead. Now we hope he will kindly forgive our offense. Thus reflecting on the sin they had committed by neglecting Lord Krishna, the Brahmins became very eager to see him, but being afraid of King Kamsa, they did not dare go to Braja. Chapter 24. Worshipping Govardhan Hill. Shukadeva Goswami said, "While staying in that very place with his brother Baladev, Lord Krishna happened to see the cowherd men busily arranging for a sacrifice to Indra. Being the omniscient supersoul, the Supreme Lord Krishna already understood the situation, yet he still humbly inquired from the elders, headed by his father, Nanda Maharaj. My dear father, kindly explain to me what this great endeavor of yours is all about. What is it meant to accomplish? If this is a ritual sacrifice, then for whose satisfaction is it intended, and by what means is it going to be executed? Please tell me about it, O Father. I have a great desire to know, and am ready to hear in good faith. Certainly, no secrets are to be kept by saintly personalities, who see all others as equal to themselves, who have no conception of mine or another's, and who do not consider who is a friend, who is an enemy, and who is neutral. One who is neutral may be avoided like an enemy, but a friend should be considered like one's own self. When people in this world perform activities, sometimes they understand what they are doing, and sometimes they don't. Those who know what they are doing achieve success in their work, whereas ignorant people do not. Such being the case, this ritualistic endeavor of yours should be clearly explained to me. Is it a ceremony based on scriptural injunction, or simply a custom of ordinary society? Nanda Maharaj replied, "The great Lord Indra is the controller of the rain. The clouds are his personal representatives, and they directly provide rainwater, which gives happiness and sustenance to all creatures. Not only we, my dear son, but also many other men worship him, the Lord and Master of the rain-giving clouds. We offer him grain and other paraphernalia of worship produced through his own discharge in the form of rain. By accepting the remnants of sacrifices performed for Indra, people sustain their lives and accomplish the threefold aims of religiosity, economic development, and sense gratification. Thus, Lord Indra is the agent responsible for the fruitive success of industrious people. This religious principle is based on sound tradition. Anyone who rejects it out of lust, enmity, fear, or greed will certainly fail to achieve good fortune." Shukadeva Goswami said, "When Lord Krishna heard the statements of his father, Nanda, and other senior residents of Braja, he addressed his father as follows to arouse anger in Lord Indra. It is by the force of karma that a living entity takes birth, and it is by karma alone that he meets his destruction. His happiness, distress, fear, and sense of security all arise as the effects of karma. Even if there is some supreme controller who awards all others the results of their activities, he must also depend upon a performer's engaging in activity. After all, there is no question of being the bestower of fruitive results unless fruitive activities have actually been performed. Living beings in this world are forced to experience the consequences of their own particular previous work. Since Lord Indra cannot in any way change the destiny of human beings, which is born of their own nature, why should people worship him? Every individual is under the control of his own conditioned nature, and thus he must follow that nature. This entire universe with all its demigods, demons, and human beings is based on the conditioned nature of the living entities. Because it is karma that causes the conditioned living entity to accept and then give up different high and low-grade material bodies, this karma is his enemy, friend, and neutral witness, his spiritual master and controlling lord. Therefore, one should seriously worship work itself. A person should remain in the position corresponding to his nature and should perform his own duty. Indeed, that by which we may live nicely is really our worshipable deity. If one thing is actually sustaining our life, but we take shelter of something else, how can we achieve any real benefit? We would be like an unfaithful woman who can never achieve any actual benefit by consorting with her paramour. The Brahmin maintains his life by studying and teaching the Vedas, the member of the royal order by protecting the earth, the Vaishya by trade, and the Shudra by serving the higher, twice-born classes. The occupational duties of the Vaishya are conceived in four divisions: farming, commerce, cow protection, and money lending. Out of these, we as a community are always engaged in cow protection. The causes of creation, maintenance, and destruction are the three modes of nature: goodness, passion, and ignorance. In particular, the mode of passion creates this universe and, through sexual combination, causes it to become full of variety. Impelled by the material mode of passion, the clouds pour down their rain everywhere, and by this rain, all creatures gain their sustenance. What has the great Indra to do with this arrangement? My dear father, our home is not in the cities or towns or villages. Being forest dwellers, we always live in the forest and on the hills. Therefore, may a sacrifice for the pleasure of the cows, the Brahmins, and Govardhan Hill begin. With all the paraphernalia collected for worshipping Indra, let this sacrifice be performed instead. Let many different kinds of food be cooked, from sweet rice to vegetable soups. Many kinds of fancy cakes, both baked and fried, should be prepared, and all the available milk products should be taken for this sacrifice. The Brahmins, who are learned in the Vedic mantras, must properly invoke the sacrificial fires. Then you should feed the priests with nicely prepared food and reward them with cows and other gifts. After giving the appropriate food to each of the others, including the dog eaters, the dogs, and other fallen members of society, you should give grass to the cows and then present your respectful offerings to Govardhan Hill. After everyone has eaten to his satisfaction, you should all dress and decorate yourselves handsomely, smear your bodies with sandalwood paste, and then circumambulate the cows, the Brahmins, the sacrificial fires, and Govardhan Hill. This is my idea, O Father, and you may carry it out if it appeals to you. Such a sacrifice will be very dear to the cows, the Brahmins, and Govardhan Hill, and also to me.